disposal of human bodies. Like the feces we continually produce while we are alive, the bodies we leave behind after we die can be viewed as waste in need of disposal or as nutritive resources to be recycled. Coffins slow down the microbial decomposition of dead bodies, as does embalming, which involves chemicals such as formaldehyde and alcohol that limit microbial growth and temporarily preserve flesh. The Egyptian techniques of mummification bear remarkable similarity to the Egyptian practice of preserving birds and fish through disembowelment and salting, notes Mark Kurlansky in his Salt, A World History. As discussed in Chapter 12, salting preserves flesh by inhibiting bacterial growth, primarily by limiting water activity. But the fact that billions of bodies are not piling up on the earth is clear evidence that microbes generally fully decompose corpses, undeterred by efforts to preserve them. Where it is possible, this is legal in some places and prohibited in others, bury your dead in a hole in the ground as simply as you can. Do you really even need a coffin? How about wrapping the body in a quickly biodegrading natural fabric or paper shroud instead? Even where you cannot just dig a hole in the ground, a growing green burial movement is seeking to bury dead bodies without embalming, in caskets made of biodegradable materials and without the use of other synthetic impediments to rapid microbial decomposition. The Green Burial Council has formed to encourage environmentally sustainable death care and the use of burial as a new means of protecting natural areas. Through a mix of evangelism, economic incentives, and solid science, our mostly volunteer organization has become the standard bearer in this nascent field and the conduit for conservation at an intersection that's never been crossed. Our legacy can be nutrients for trees rather than embalming fluids and garish caskets made of materials that resist decomposition. Fiber and building arts. Fermentation, as a fundamental mode of processing organic materials, has been used widely in various techniques of fiber arts, construction, and decorative finishing. Bioplastics. Most of the biodegradable plant-based plastics, being used as green alternatives for packaging and disposable cups, plates, and cutlery, are products of fermentation. One corn-based plastic is polylactic acid, or PLA. Corn sugars are fermented into lactic acid, which is then purified and subjected to a series of chemical manipulations to transform it into PLA. Similar processes are being applied to potato starch, cassava, sugarcane, and soybeans. They could potentially be applied to any carbohydrate fermentable into lactic acid. Redding. The word red is used to describe soaking or moistening flax, hemp, or other stalky fiber plants, as well as coir fibers from coconut shells, cassava tubers, and other fibrous plant materials. Ret comes from the same linguistic roots as rot. The redding initiates a spontaneous fermentation that digests pectins and other compounds, thereby releasing the fibers and making them available for use in rope, yarn, paper, and so on. In the case of cassava and other fibrous starchy tubers, the fibers are removed, and the dissolved starch that settles in the liquid is the primary food product. Dyeing. Fermentation is also used in certain fiber dyeing processes. I visited Artisan Natural Dye Works in Nashville, Tennessee, www.ecodiet.com, where indigo dyes were fermenting in big vats as well as iron for another dye. Sarah and Alessandra Bellos, the sisters who operate the small batch dye works, grow their own indigo, and in fact were drawn to dyeing by their desire to fuse their interests in farming with their creative pursuits. The indigo they grow and ferment and dye with in Nashville's temperate climate is technically of the knotweed family, Persicaria tinctoria, called Japanese indigo, Chinese indigo, dyer's knotweed, and undoubtedly other names, rather than the indigofera tinctoria used in India. Indigo can describe dye made from a number of different plants, including Persicaria tinctoria. Other plants in the indigofera genus, woad, Isatis tinctoria, and others, all processed by fermentation, at least historically, until the discovery of faster chemical processes beginning near the end of the 19th century. Like so many fermentation processes, indigo dyeing is an alchemical wonder. First, the pigment is extracted from the plants through a preliminary fermentation process, which can either proceed as a hot aerobic composting process yielding a pigment-rich paste, or as an anaerobic ferment immersed in water. As pigments infuse into the water and it ferments, the water goes from clear to brown to lime antifreeze green, according to Sarah and Alessandra. This is the color of the pigment in its soluble form. It can be precipitated into an insoluble form by adding hydrated lime and actively agitated and aerating it. The acidic fermented infusion reacts with the alkaline lime and oxidizes, producing a blue foam and causing the blue pigment to precipitate into a sludge of insoluble particulate. This particulate can be stored wet, but is typically dried into powdery cakes for transport and commerce. Then the pigment, in whichever form, is introduced into a vat of water with soda ash and a carbohydrate nutrient, such as madder or roasted barley, to undergo reduction of oxygen and fermentation. Urine has also been used in indigo fermentation vats. As the pigment dissolves in an anaerobic environment, it loses its blue color. Minimize disturbance of the vat as it can introduce oxygen and retard the dissolution of the pigment. As days and weeks pass, the vat develops a strong, fishy odor. Once a coppery sheen develops on the surface of the vat, it's ready for dyeing. Fibers or garments dipped into the indigo vat come out yellow-green, and only after they are removed from the solution and exposed to air do they turn to blue as they oxidize. It's a dramatic shift, like watching a photographic print develop. To obtain a dark, rich blue color, you must generally dip the fibers multiple times, allowing full oxidation between dips. Indigo is not the only fermented dye. In addition to indigo, the Bellows sisters had a vat of fermenting iron. Dr. S. Sikar of Bharathidasan University in Tamil Nadu, India, compiler of the Database on Microbial Traditional Knowledge of India, writes that various types of natural dyes and adhesives for dyeing are prepared through traditional fermentation by Mite, ethnic people of Manipur, in the northeast of India, including not only a form of indigo, but plants yielding colors across the spectrum, yellow, pink, red, violet, brown, and black. Natural building. Building with natural materials is obviously the origin of all construction. Even now in the 21st century, half the world's population continues to live in earthen dwellings, which are more thermally comfortable than the cement bunkers or house trailers that often replace them, writes Carol Cruz in Clay Culture, Plasters, Paints, and Preservation. Although building practices have become more and more based upon synthetic materials, steel, cement, plastic, fiberglass, asphalt, vinyl, pressure-treated lumber, etc., there has been a revival in recent years of building with earthen materials. I was lucky enough to know some natural building revivalists in the 1990s, and I learned from them. With minimal guidance and much perseverance and help, I built a beautiful, luxurious living space out of mud and straw and fell in love with the process. Compared to building with wood, building with mud is easy and much more forgiving. With barely any learning curve, children and anyone willing to get their hands dirty can be put right to work. Whereas carpentry errors generally get compounded, requiring remediation at each subsequent step, mudding errors are easily plastered over, as experience teaches you the nuance of judging appropriate mixing proportions. In communicating to others how to find the right proportions, I always find myself resorting to food metaphors. Just as wheat and water can be combined to obtain so many distinctive forms, so too can earth, water, and straw. One technique I used, known as slip straw, involves first mixing a clay slip, clay and water in a liquid suspension thick like cream, thick enough to remain coating your hand when you remove it from stirring the solution. You lightly coat the straw with slip, then pack it forcefully into the wall space defined by boards affixed to the inside and outside between structural posts. The benefit of this method is high straw content, which creates good insulation without the excessive bulk of straw bale walls. To coat straw with slip, you first disassemble part of a straw bale on a tarp, separating individual stalks as much as possible. Then you spread some slip around the pile of straw, a little at a time, and toss, just as you might toss a salad when you dress it. The objective is to coat all the straw using as little slip as you can. Earth, sand, water, and straw can be mixed thick into a dough-like cob mix that holds its own form for building walls. Like dough, it needs enough water for all the elements to become bound together, but not so much that it can no longer hold its form. In a plaster application to finish an already constructed wall, these same ingredients, and often others, are used, but with more water to make a spreadable consistency, something like a batter. A crucial step in all of these processes is soaking the clay, exactly as with wheat. Carol Cruz explains the properties of clay. The crystalline nature of clay molecules enables them to bind together in a linear way to form very thin platelets of different lengths which slide over one another like a deck of wet playing cards, creating plasticity and malleability in the clay body as the platelets absorb water between the layers, in addition to that trapped within the molecular structure. Only 1 or 2 nanometers thick, the microscopic platelets stick to each other, to water, and to other objects because of an electrostatic charge on their edges. The cohesive force in clay particles is partially neutralized through the absorption of water, making the clay fluid and malleable, achieving that magic consistency between liquid and solid. When clay is left in water, after it becomes fully saturated with water between all the layers of platelets, over time, they align themselves in a more uniform way, which improves the consistency and workability of the mass, explains Cruz. In China, at least in the old days, each generation would prepare large pits of clay and cover them with straw for the next generation of potters, then use the one prepared for them years before. In India, builders pile up the wet mud and cover it for at least 2 weeks before using it. Cruz describes the extended soaking of clay as fermenting. Although minerals without organic material cannot ferment, the reality that all clays contain impurities, including organic matter, means that fermentation does occur. Aged clay can begin to smell absolutely awful, warns Cruz. In such an event, she recommends adding EM-1, effective microorganisms, as remediation. For use in building, soaked clay is mixed with other substances, almost always fiber and aggregate, and in some applications additional binders and hardeners. Aggregate is typically sand. Clay without aggregate tends to shrink and crack. In many places, the earth you can dig already contains a good balance between clay and sand for building. In most of the earthen building I have done, I have had to add lots of sand to dense, clayey earth. In addition, you need fiber to give structure and tensile strength. Straw is most famous, but other fibers can be substituted. For finer plaster work, I've used hair and dried grated horse manure, which is essentially individual grass fibers with a sticky coating. In contrast with the clay, best pre-soaked, the fiber generally is kept dry until ready to mix and use. In mixing and application, it gets wet, but then begins to dry and ferments for only a minimum of time. Too much decomposition would compromise the strength of the fibers. Some of the binders people use in earthen plasters and paints are foods. Wheat paste is a thin batter of flour and water cooked into a gluey paste. This mix has been popular with urban activists and street artists. I learned to mix wheat paste into earthen plasters, and it definitely contributes to the stickiness of the mix. But only mix as much as you're going to use that day, because if you leave it out overnight and the wheat ferments, the plaster loses body and cohesiveness and gets too thin to work with. Fermentation is not always the best thing. A food-based binder that is generally fermented when used to strengthen or coat earthen plasters is casein. Caseins are the group of milk proteins that form curds, as opposed to whey. Casein proteins are organized as clusters floating in the milk, called micelles. In acid conditions, the micelles react by coming together into larger clusters. This phenomenon underlies cheesemaking and yogurt making. The same binding power that allows caseins to restructure liquid milk into solid forms can be incorporated into earthen plaster mixes via casein. I will not get into the specific plaster-making techniques, but Carol Cruz's book and others have much detail. The casein itself could be yogurt hung as yogurt cheese, milk curdled with rennet or vinegar, buttermilk, or other variations. I've even used powdered milk in plaster mixes. All milk has caseins. Any milk makes good glue, summarizes Cruz. Another natural wall finish involving fermentation is lime-based paint incorporating fermented cactus, which I heard about from my friends Annie Danger and Raina, who together used this technique to paint Annie's San Francisco apartment. The gooey fermented cactus acts as the sticky-slash-glossy-slash-latexy part of the paint, explains Annie. This was a non-toxic process to an almost disorienting degree, she says. It felt amazing and weird to paint for a few days and never feel ill from paint fumes. What a treat! The first step in preparing this or any lime-based paint is hydrating or slaking the lime. The lime needs to soak in water for a minimum of 1 week, ideally longer, so mix it in a bucket that can be tied up for a while and mix more than you think you'll need so you don't have to wait another week for more to cure if you run out. The lime curing is not a fermentation process, but rather a chemical reaction between the lime and water. Use type S lime, usually sold at building supply stores. Fill your bucket about halfway with water, then carefully sift lime into it, cup by cup, and stir. Get out the old personal protective equipment, making sure to use a mask/filter to protect your lungs, and eye protection that completely wraps around, advises Annie. You don't want the lime to hydrate using your body fluids. It's not pretty. Add lime until the water begins to thicken, something like pancake batter. A week is the minimum length of time the lime should hydrate. The longer you slake your lime, the better it will be, says Annie. If you have extra slaked lime left over, you can store it indefinitely in a sealed container. After your lime is slaked, it's time to prepare the cactus nopales, the spiny pads of cacti of the Opuntia genus, available at Latin American groceries. Use another bucket for fermenting the nopales. Fill it no more than halfway with warm water, plus 1 cup of salt per gallon, 60 milliliters per liter. Figure about 10 pounds of nopales per gallon of water, just over a kilogram per liter. 10 pounds or 4 kilograms of nopales was adequate for Reina and Annie to cover a 12-foot or 4-meter square room. There is no need to remove the spines from the nopales, as is typically required to cook with them. Simply slice the pads into thin, 1/4 to 1/2 inch or 1 centimeter, slivers. Annie recommends the following method to minimize contact between your hands and the prickly nopales. Glove up on your non-dominant hand and gingerly take hold of the base of a nopal paddle. Using your good cutting hand, stand over the basket and slash at the cactus carefully, hacking thin as possible slivers off the width of the cactus and letting them fall directly into the bucket. Make sure nopales slivers are covered with brine, stir, cover, and leave to ferment a few days, stirring daily and taking note of the changing texture as cactus goo releases into the water and ferments. The goal is to get the cactus goo good and pickled/extracted, but not outright rotten, explains Annie. At San Francisco's moderate temperatures, it took about 3 days. In a warmer place, the fermentation would go faster. In a cooler spot, slower. As in any ferment, more salt would slow down the process. Reina notes that other kinds of cacti/succulents would work as well if they were more abundant. For example, aloe vera has a great goo content. Once the cactus goo is fermented, strain it through a sieve to remove cactus slivers, leaving you with what Annie calls pure, magnificent, amber-colored cactus goo. Then mix the goo with slaked lime. Annie and Reina experimented with different proportions and decided to work with 3 parts cactus goo to 2 parts slaked lime. A thinner, say 4-to-1, paint will be more like a glaze, needing many layers to build up opacity. You can work with this paint unpigmented for a yellowish-white wash that has a bit of luminescent sheen, or add pigments of any colors desired. Add pigments just a little at a time. Once you think you have achieved the color you want, test paint in an unobtrusive spot to see how the color dries and adjust proportions and pigments as necessary. This paint dries quickly and will require a minimum of 2 coats, possibly more. Yet another fermented building material, this one a new innovation rather than gleaned from clear historical tradition, is a mycelial mat grown by fungi on agricultural byproducts such as cotton burrs and buckwheat hulls, thereby binding the nutrient substrates together into a rigid board with lots of air pockets, something like styrofoam insulation, except without glues or resins, totally natural and totally biodegradable. Mycelial insulation is commercially available as GreenSolate. The developers of the product won one of Popular Science magazine's invention awards in 2009. The magazine explained, the mixture is placed inside a panel, or whatever shape is required, and after 10 to 14 days, the mycelia develop a dense network. Just 1 cubic inch of the white and brown specked GreenSolate insulation contains 8 miles of interconnected mycelia strands. The panels are dried in an oven at between 100 degrees and 150 degrees Fahrenheit to stop mycelia growth, and at the end of 2 weeks, they're ready for your walls. The same process is also being used to create eco-friendly packaging. Unfortunately, neither the Popular Science article nor the website of the product's manufacturer specifies what species of fungus they are using, but I suppose that's the proprietary aspect of their enterprise. It would be a fun project for an experimentalist to try this DIY, experimenting with different fungal species grown in forms. Energy production. Alcohol, the most widely consumed product of fermentation, also known as ethanol, can be burned as fuel. Methane, another product of fermentation, can also be burned as fuel. Fermentation processes figure quite prominently in discussions of renewable energy and energy self-sufficiency. Ethanol. Most gas stations in the United States are already pumping ethanol-gasoline blends. Government policy and industry players have been promoting this objective for years. The idea that fast-growing annual crops can be turned into fuel is very appealing, and many people believe that it is a path to energy self-sufficiency and sustainability. Most of the ethanol produced in the United States is fermented from corn, but in Brazil, the world's next biggest producer of ethanol, it is made primarily from sugarcane. After fermentation, the ethanol must be concentrated by distillation, like hard liquor, only several times over, to reach as close as possible to 200 proof, or 100% alcohol. As ethanol production has risen in recent years, it has come to be blamed for rising corn prices and rising food prices more broadly. A Congressional Budget Office report explains, "In 2008, nearly 3 billion bushels of corn were used to produce ethanol in the United States. That amount constituted an increase over the previous year of almost 1 billion bushels. The demand for corn for ethanol production, along with other factors, exerted upward pressure on corn prices, which rose by more than 50% between April 2007 and April 2008. Rising demand for corn also increased the demand for cropland and the price of animal feed. Those effects in turn raised the price of many farm commodities, such as soybeans, meat, poultry, and dairy products, and consequently the retail price of food." Renewable fuel production is a laudable goal, but turning food crops into fuel has huge economic ramifications, pitting basic human needs against our insatiable desire for mobility and convenience. Producing fuel from plant monocultures has been successfully marketed as green, yet the push for biofuels has wrought much environmental devastation. Corn, sugarcane, and other monocultures can only be grown with heavy applications of synthetic nitrogen fertilizers. Food and agriculture writer Tom Philpott asks, "Has there ever been a green technology more ecologically discredited than corn-based ethanol?" In Brazil, vast expanses of the Amazon rainforest have been and continue to be cleared to make way for sugarcane fields for the burgeoning ethanol industry there. In Colombia, Argentina, and elsewhere in South America, there have been reports of people forced from land that has sustained them and their ancestors to make way for vast expanses of biofuel crops. Some of the cutting-edge research in biofuels involves finding non-food materials to turn into fuels, such as switchgrass for ethanol or algae for biodiesel, a whole other process that does not involve fermentation. But even non-edible feedstocks require land, water, labor, and other precious resources. Biofuels are no panacea. The process for making ethanol from carbohydrates begins with the processes covered in Chapter 9 for making alcohol from grains and starchy tubers. Usually, amylase enzymes are introduced to break down starches into simple sugars, a technological application of the molds used in Asian rice beverages. These enzymes are also frequently used in making tuber or grain-based distilled spirits. Malt can be introduced rather than enzymes. After the initial carbohydrate conversion, the wort is boiled, and once it cools, yeast is introduced to initiate fermentation. To make ethanol, the resulting fermented beverage is distilled, Chapter 9, to make concentrate alcohol. Ethanol of 200 proof, pure enough to be mixed with gasoline, is not generally regarded as within the reach of homebrewers without very specialized equipment. However, people have effectively run specially adapted gasoline vehicles on 180 proof, 90% pure, ethanol, or diesel engines on even lower proof blends. Methane. Another combustible product of fermentation that people have developed as an energy source is methane. Methane, also known as swamp gas or landfill gas, is a product of the anaerobic digestion that occurs in sewage treatment and some composting. Methane is also the primary component of natural gas extracted from the earth that is widely used to heat homes and water and cook food. Biogas, produced as a byproduct from anaerobic digestion of sewage, can be similarly used, and has also been used to power vehicles, sewage treatment, or potentially anything. The idea of capturing methane from anaerobic decomposition processes is not new. Nearly 1,000 years ago, in the 13th century, Marco Polo reported on the practice as he observed it in China. And 3,000 years ago, the Assyrians were using it to heat water for bathing. In recent decades, technologies have improved for capturing and refining biogas. The apparatus is usually referred to as a digester. The internet is full of do-it-yourself designs for building an anaerobic digester for harnessing methane biogas. Biogas production and use accomplishes many useful things simultaneously. It turns what would otherwise be polluting waste streams of animal and human excrement into a fuel resource. Its use as fuel also prevents methane, a major contributor to global warming, from being released into the atmosphere. And by providing primarily rural people with fuel for heating and cooking, biogas also saves trees from being cut. China is the world leader in biogas usage, with 17 million digesters and an annual biogas production of 6.5 billion cubic meters as of 2005, with ambitious plans for more. Biogas is at the center of a burgeoning eco-economy in China, reports the UK-based Institute of Science in Society. Medicinal applications of fermentation. Many traditional healing systems have prepared medications by fermentation. Chapter 4 discussed herbal elixir meads and how fermenting alcohol has been long used as a means of preserving and using plant medicine. The Indian Ayurveda tradition uses fermented forms of herbs called arishtas and asavas. These are regarded as valuable therapeutics due to their efficacy and desirable features, according to Dr. S. Sikar of Bharathidasan University in Tamil Nadu, India, whose online database on microbial traditional knowledge of India describes dozens of such preparations. Chinese Confucianism regarded fermented condiments as a means of regulating health by balancing individuals with the food they eat, the seasons, their individual constitutions, and so forth. Medicine derived from fermentation is not a new idea. Every organism and microbial community secretes compounds that inhibit some of its potential competitors. This is the observation behind antibiotic drugs. Scottish biologist Alexander Fleming was studying staphylococci bacteria in 1928 when he observed that an accidental mold growth in a few petri dishes destroyed those cultures. He identified the mold as being of the Penicillium genus and began investigating its antibacterial properties, ushering in a new era in medicine. Mushrooms as well as molds have been found to possess antibacterial as well as antiviral properties. Diseases of plants typically do not afflict humans, whereas diseases of fungi do, points out Paul Stamets. Since humans, animals, and fungi share common microbial antagonists, humans can benefit from the natural defensive strategies of fungi that produce antibiotics to fight infection from microorganisms. Hence, it is not surprising our most significant antibacterial antibiotics have been derived from fungi. While most antibiotics in use are derived from molds, Stamets has been demonstrating antimicrobial action in various mushrooms, most notably the woody polypore varieties. The pharmaceutical industry has been slow to explore mushrooms for antibiotic activity, in part because Basidiomycetes fungi, mushrooms, are slower growing in fermentation and less yielding compared to the mold fungi, explained Stamets. The mushroom genome stands out as a virtually untapped resource for novel antimicrobials, and may be society's greatest protection against microbial diseases. Bacteria have come to play a very important role in pharmaceutical production. With the emergence of recombinant DNA technology, genes for producing specific compounds began being inserted into bacterial cells. Many common pharmaceutical products are now produced by genetically engineered bacteria, including insulin, interferon, tumor necrosis factor, and others. A bacteriology textbook enthusiastically summarizes, "The possibilities of biotechnology are endless considering the gene reservoirs and genetic capabilities within the bacteria." In addition to bacteria, geneticists have been able to insert genes to produce pharmaceutical compounds into plants, raising the possibility that if pollen from the genetically modified plants were to escape, it could contaminate other plant populations with powerful pharmaceutical chemicals. Like nutrients in food, nutritional supplements can also be enhanced and made more bioavailable by fermentation. The supplement company New Chapter makes food-based supplements cultured in probiotics to deliver the full spectrum of nature's benefits. Very different in its nature, yet related because it is a drug, tobacco is sometimes fermented, especially for cigars. Cigar maker Altadis explains on its website how cigar tobacco is fermented. Tobacco fermentation means laying the leaves into huge bulks, the centers of which develop heat. The heat in the center of a bulk should not be allowed to exceed about 115 degrees to 130 degrees Fahrenheit, 46 to 54 degrees Celsius, depending on the type of tobacco, otherwise it will be ruined, burned out, so to speak. When it gets up to that temperature, and it will do so in its own time depending on the leaf and its condition, the bulk gets turned inside out and the heat buildup, fermentation, begins again. When the heat levels off, the fermentation is complete. This could occur after 4 turns or 8 turns, referred to as sweats in the trade. Over-fermentation will ruin the leaf, cause it to become spent, and lose its flavor and aroma. During sweating, the fermentation process causes the emission of nitrogen compounds and other chemical compounds, and reduces somewhat the nicotine content. After fermentation, further aging in bales helps to settle the leaf and enhances flavor and burning quality. That sounds exactly like a compost pile. Fermentation for skincare and aromatherapy. Another way of using fermentation is skincare. Osmosis Spa in Freestone, California, offers a Japanese tradition, since the 1940s anyway, of bathing in a fermenting mix of sawdust and rice bran. Osmosis uses a starter from Japan to culture the mixture and ferments it for a while, turning the pile periodically, as it generates heat and slowly breaks down the plant fibers. Once the fermenting sawdust and rice bran is in the tubs, huge wooden crates, it is continually remixed, and the high level of microbial activity keeps it safe and clean. According to the Osmosis website, the heat in the cedar enzyme bath differs from other heat treatments in that it is produced biologically by a fermentation process. This process requires over 600 active enzymes. The largest organ of the body, the skin, comes in direct contact with intense enzyme activity in the cedar enzyme bath, which, in addition to heat, produces its own electrochemical environment. This combination of heat and energy influences body chemistry and natural cleansing processes, and breaks down body wastes in the subcutaneous layer of the skin. The surface of your skin, your pores, and even the cells themselves are thoroughly cleansed. I had the pleasure of visiting Osmosis as the guest of its founder, Michael Stusser, who invited me to participate in the spectacular Freestone Fermentation Festival, which he organized. When I arrived at the tub, a cavity had been dug out of it, roughly my size, contoured to suggest a position halfway between lying and sitting, reclining with head sticking out and knees raised. I got in and adjusted my position. Then Kristen, my guide for the experience, buried me in it, reminding me of being buried in sand at the beach as a child. It was very cozy, soft and moist, but also very hot in there, as hot as 140 degrees Fahrenheit or 60 degrees Celsius, according to Michael, though the material in contact with your skin forms an insulation barrier. Kristen encouraged me to uncover limbs as necessary to be comfortable, and she kept offering me cold water with a bent straw and swabbing my face with a cool, water-soaked towel. Lying there in the sweaty heat of frenzied microbial activity while simultaneously being pampered, it was easy to imagine the dead tissue on my skin being digested by billions of bacteria. I stayed in the tub for about 20 minutes, followed by a brush down to remove sawdust and rice bran, a long shower and misting, and finally a deep, wonderful massage. After the whole experience, I felt like jelly, reborn and deeply relaxed. Through the years, people have emailed me describing their practices and experiments with fermented skincare products. Many common ingredients in skincare products, including honey, cream, milk, coconut, botanical herbs, readily ferment. Fermenting them may alter them in some positive ways, though I have come across no research in this area and have not experimented myself beyond kombucha mother and sauerkraut facials, both wonderful. A Canadian company, Kefiplant, with a proprietary process called Kefiec, using organisms derived from kefir grains, manufactures a starter for fermented herbal skincare products. When botanicals are fermented by Kefiplant, the naturally occurring phytocompounds in the plant are liberated, explains the company's website. These liberated molecules can now be readily absorbed and efficiently utilized by the body. Another related application of fermentation is the aromatherapy of potpourri. The French word potpourri translates to rotten pot, and originally potpourri was not a dry mix as we find today, but rather a pot of rose petals and other aromatic herbs, fermented and moist. Fermentation was an essential part of the processing, enabling the petals and their aroma to be preserved. The process is straightforward. Layer fresh rose petals with salt at a ratio of roughly 3 parts rose petals to 1 part salt. Weigh down, as for sauerkraut, to keep rose petals submerged. Ferment for at least 2 weeks, or as long as 6 weeks. The mass of roses should dry out into a crummy, moist cake. Crumble, add other aromatic flowers and spices, store in a jar, and open as scenting is desired. Fermentation art. One final non-food application of fermentation is in the realm of art. Surely fermentation has inspired art, song, and poetry from the earliest emergence of each of these forms of expression. Some artists are using fermentation itself as a mode of expression. One example is the kombucha garments produced by Suzanne Lee, a research fellow at the School of Fashion and Textiles in London. Mike Kuhl writes that he and a friend performed their electronic music while they also made sauerkraut on stage. A microphone picked up all the chopping and stomping noises and incorporated it into the mix. At the end, we sang a German Schlager about sauerkraut. It was a huge success. Jennifer Whiteman is a biologist-artist who created installations of mud and water enclosed in frames, fermenting, called Winogradsky-Rothko, Bacterial Ecosystem as Pastoral Landscape. In the artist's own words, made in the dimensions of a Mark Rothko painting, applying a microbiology technique developed by a 19th-century soil scientist, Sergei Vinogradsky, pigmented bacteria that existed in the mud and water composed a landscape. As bacteria colonize their optimal zones, they change their environments by depleting their resources and releasing byproducts. As a bacterial species reaches its carrying capacity, the environment no longer hospitable to the original colonizer may now be the optimal environment for a potential successor to that zone, resulting in an evolving color field of living pigments. The appearance/disappearance of color indicates both procurement and loss of finite material resources. The agents that act out upon the landscape and synthesize change become acted upon by their consequentially changed world. The artist explains that for her, decomposition represents beginnings, change, contingencies of cause and effect, interconnectedness, possibility. Perhaps decomposition is where my hope for the world lies.